Here at Renew Energy Partners, climate change is very important to us, and so is beer. In every episode of the Green Beers podcast, we taste a beer together. We talk about the brewery and their sustainability practices. And then we talk about a topic relating to our work in decarbonizing buildings and mitigating climate change. Welcome to Green Beers. My name is Mike Savage, and I'm here with
Charlie Lord,
Nathan Montgomery,
and Deirdre Lord.
Yes, people, my sister, our very special guest, the founder of the Megawatt Hour, Deirdre Lord.
So happy to be here.
It's great to have you. Charlie, you ruined my initial joke, which was going to be any relation, but here we are.
I saw when you laughed that I had stolen a good one-liner. Yes, indeed, my sister.
Deirdre, so how's it, being Charlie's brother? We'll start there, and then we'll get
I'm
into some
beer. I'm his sister, for starters.
Oh, yeah. Oh,
my. Just clear up that gender confusion. It's great, actually.
About six cups.
Six cups in?
Too much coffee. Yeah, coffee, not beer, but yeah.
No, it's been great. And, I think when we were really much younger, it was less collegial.
Yeah, I think that's a fair depiction of it.
But then as we grew up, we, became better and better friends. And I actually remember when we both realized that we were interested in environmental issues. You were in law school, I think, and I was in college. And so it's been even more fun just having this shared commitment and passion.
Yeah, and I want to ask you about that when we get into it, actually. I was thinking the other day, I remember that too, but I can't remember what it is that triggered it for you back then. So we'll get into that. Should we open the beers? Okay.
Absolutely.
Dear, do you want to tell us about the beers that you brought, the breweries anyway?
Yes, definitely. In fact, I had intended originally to bring some beers from the Catskills and didn't get a chance to do that. But I wanted to bring New York beers because I'm based in New York. The company's based in New York. So we have a beer from the Hudson Valley Brewery, which is, I believe, in Beacon, New York. And then Destination Unknown is a brewery on Long Island. And
beautiful.
So we have an IPA from Destination Unknown. And what's the beer of the...
We have a Windrow, a corn lager from Hudson Valley Brewery. So we're having a twofer today, two New York State craft brews to add to the beer mix on Green Beers Podcast.
Yes. And the truth is that I am not a beer connoisseur. I'm more a tequila person, but this is not called green tequila. So really excited to
We may have a special tequila episode in season four, but we thank you for joining us on the beer side. And these are interesting looking beers. So, all right, we're going to taste them and then we'll jump right in.
There's been a lot of weddings for me this year, and tequila has honestly been the drink of choice. But I'll let you guys. I'm remote today, so I'll let you guys give the first taste test here.
Well, I they're both great. The corn lager, usually when you have a lager with a unusual grain, it's not a good sign for me, but actually I like this one. When we get to the taste test at the end, but I will say right out of the gate, I'm happy with that one.
Good. Mm-hmm. Good. I tried the corn lager first.
Yeah.
Pleasant.
Yeah.
Solid.
Yeah. And then this is a hazy IPA from Destination Unknown or Dubco. So we're going to rate the beer at the end. But I would love to hear, because you and I were thinking about the same thing, which was that I was in law school, definitely headed towards something in the environment, and you were majoring in environmental studies.
English and environmental studies.
English and environmental studies. And I get asked periodically, what is it that brought you into to a focus in, on a career in the environment? But do you remember what the event or series of events or activities it was that kicked it off for you?
Yes, I do. And I love that question. We grew up actually with a mother who was in a an environmental group in the 70s,
yep.
Consumer Action Now.
Bell bottoms.
Yep.
Beaded hair.
The whole deal.
The whole
deal.
Yeah.
And they were much more focused on clean air and clean water and recycling and garbage and things like that. But we were always, I think, very in touch with sort of environment and the environment,
right.
Outdoors. And
that must have been, I've said to other people, that must have been one of the first community or municipal sort of environmental advocacy groups in the country, because it was right after the passage of the Clean Air Act and the Clean Water
Correct.
Act, early 70s. There was probably a network of them. I'm assuming someone's written a history of it. It would be probably pretty fascinating.
Definitely.
But this was the New York City version of sort of municipal environmental advocacy.
Right. And yeah. What was so interesting about it and had an impact, I think, on us is that it was a real community. I mean, families would get together and talk about these issues. You know, we would go, you know, stuff envelopes, you know, right. It was really very pretty grassroots and family oriented.
Yep.
But then I majored in English and environmental studies, and I took a semester in Nepal and got very interested in international development and the environment, and decided that,
the funny part about having your sister on a podcast is I know all the stories.
You do, yep. A lot of which we will not cover.
You don't
today.
Think I could mention your gastrointestinal difficulty in front of a Nepalese holy man? No. All right.
We'll just
sorry.
Skip
we digress.
Right over that one. Yeah. I was concerned about having some kind of pragmatic response that supported international development and accelerated international development without following the path that developed countries had in terms of the environment and especially carbon emissions. And then as a senior in college, I took a geology course. And the professor said, I'm just going to present you with the science. I'm not going to weigh in. You know, the environmental studies program was very policy oriented and very focused on engagement and policy and interaction. And this professor just said, I'm just going to provide you with the science. And so I came out and he said, I'm not going to give you my opinion. I came out of that course thinking, well, as soon as this information gets out, you know, we're all going to change our behavior and climate is really, you know, everyone will realize, you know, that climate change is a crisis.
Wow. And this is 1989. This is even before Al Gore published his first book came out in 92.
Yeah. Oh.
The first Al Gore book on climate came out in 92, so this was early.
It was earlier, yeah. And so I thought at that point, oh, well, information will come out and we will all change our behavior.
Right.
And so I then went into an international energy conservation organization that focused on energy and policy and technology, and worked in India and Chile, and really, you know, the information did start to emerge. But then, you know, people's behavior really wasn't changing. And so then when the US markets deregulated, my thinking then was, well, as soon as people see, you know, the impact on their, and have transparent and very real, kind of price signals around energy, then they'll change their behavior. They'll invest in efficiency. They'll invest in renewables. But it was really a combination, to get back to your original question, a combination of the studies that I had in college and just my own personal experience.
Yeah, that's powerful. I mean, it's powerful that the trip to Nepal and the you know, you loved that landscape. You loved what you learned from the Tibet, the Buddhist tradition around their care for the environment, as I
Correct.
Remember. And then thinking, how can we create sustainable, prosperous future for communities in the developing world without making the mistakes that we've made before. But I think the thing that's really powerful too is the recognition that you were thinking about climate change in the late 80s, right? You were you had the reaction that the early pioneers in the field did, which was this is a crisis, and it took inordinately long before we arrived at that at a more general appreciation.
Well, and I think part of the reason that I had that awareness was because of the people I was working with at the International Institute for Energy Conservation, IIEC. There were people, you know, Amory Lovins was on our board, and there were people who were really raising the alarm. My colleagues, Michael Totten and Russell Sturm, they were my first bosses, and they were very, very aware of what was to come, and were very focused on you know, all aspects of trying to tackle that.
Right, and the science was there, as you say. The science was there. What's powerful about that science is that the forecasts that were first generated then about what would happen and how it would unfold are remarkably were remarkably accurate at the time.
Yeah.
It's really quite something. So. Fast forward, you're at IIEC and the markets deregulate and you launch what really is this whole phase of your career and your entrepreneurship.
Correct.
You and I, that's the other thing. Someone could do a survey of this, but it's unusual to have siblings who are entrepreneurs all over the place. And you and I are both entrepreneurs. Our brother started a nonprofit. So.
Yeah.
I don't know where our parents went wrong. Nobody got a good solid job.
Yeah. I mean, I used to make the joke when we started our first company, Juice Energy. I went and worked with New Energy Ventures, which became Constellation, which is a well-established company. And then two of my colleagues from that business and I went to start Juice. And you know, our parents' friends would say, well, oh, you know, your brothers, I think even you at the time were still in the nonprofit and everyone's in your family's in the nonprofit world. You know, what happened to you? And I said, oh, don't worry, we're not making any profits.
Well, that's funny because I like to tell the story that when I moved from the nonprofit world to Renew, my wife said to people, my husband left the nonprofit world to go to the for-profit world and ended up in the no-profit world. No, that's not true anymore. I hasten to add Renew is a thriving business,
right.
But we did have the startup phase.
That's part of what you get, you know? And so, you know, I decided when I moved into the private sector that I was going to start a green power retailer. A retailer that was focused on renewable energy, but that I needed maybe a couple years to figure out retail. And a couple years turned in really to 9 years because it was, even though it wasn't my own business, it was pretty much the Wild West in retail. And there was a lot of learning to do, and it was very exciting and very fulfilling, and I kept getting more and more responsibility.
And for our list, go ahead, Micah.
Yeah, I think we're all the same place with the listeners. What is retail, right? What you know,
good
can
question.
You describe that market?
Yeah. Yep. So basically from about Maine down to DC and then Ohio, Texas, Michigan to some extent, and California a bit. All of those states and Texas. Did I mention Texas?
Double plug
small,
for Texas.
Small
That's
market.
The way they like it.
any customer in any of those markets can choose to buy their electricity and natural gas for the most part from someone other than their local utility. So when I talk about retail, I mean that customers can choose another supplier other than their local utility. And the local utilities generally had to divest of their generating assets. And so generation is competitive and you can buy your supply from any number of suppliers who who then are buying from generators and from the wholesale market.
And when we talk, or when you talk about deregulated markets, it's no more complicated than that, that the generation is split from the distribution.
Correct.
And that the end user, households or businesses, can Correct. Buy from anybody, and they don't have to buy from the plant in their own state.
Exactly.
Or the plant owned by their utility.
Correct. Right. Yeah.
Which so gives retail, for my layman terms, is right. You're connecting the buyers to the now generators in an open market.
Would yes. that be? Yeah. I mean, you need a supplier who manages the risk around buying and selling wholesale energy, but yes, you can go to another supplier and buy from someone other than your local utility.
Correct. And what's interesting about that, which was obviously the insight behind Juice, which had a commitment to offering people the ability to buy green energy, is that not only are you able to compete for price as the buyer or look for the best price, you can also look for the mix you want, right? If you're stuck Correct. With our own utility, the best we could do to get green power would be to, I suppose, lobby our states to make our utilities change the mix of their generating assets. Whereas right. now you can go out and say, no, I'm going to vote with my wallet. I'm going to go buy green.
Correct.
Right.
Correct. And actually, many, many states, most states do have a renewable portfolio standard that mm-hmm. the local distribution utility has to deliver and that the suppliers have to deliver. But what customers, and in the early days, that really didn't exist. And so customers would say, you know, can I buy the renewable attributes from a wind farm to, you know, to green up my supply? But now what customers typically do is say, you know, I want to go above and beyond what the renewable portfolio standard tells me I have to buy, and I want to buy 100% wind energy or solar or some combination. Yeah. Right. Mm-hmm.
So you launched Juice, which was...
Had a great experience at Constellation and then launched Juice in 2006. And we wanted to provide complete transparency to customers so that customers could really see, you know, and understand what their costs were and what was driving their costs. And we also typically provided every customer with at least some percentage of renewable energy. The ultimate goal of that business was going to be really trying to link customers much more directly to renewable assets, you know, whether it was a wind farm or solar. And then that business closed. We closed that business when Lehman Brothers filed for bankruptcy, because we had a credit and working capital facility with Lehman Brothers. And so,
oops, that wasn't your fault.
That was, you know, we talk about the roller coaster of being an entrepreneur.
Yeah.
And we had dealt with a lot of challenges. And actually I was on maternity leave when things started to unwind. And I remember I called my business partners, and we dealt with every possible challenge, you know, from people challenges to, you know, product issues and marketing. And so I said, well, this doesn't look so great. What are we going to do about it? Because we'd always come up. That's what you do as an entrepreneur. You find
a
solution,
you
figure out the answer. And there was just silence on the other end of the phone. And so I left, you know, I packed up and went back to work, you know, a month after or 6 weeks after having a child. And we...
Oh, you know, I never put that math together. So you just had Charlie and you went back
yes.
to the office.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah. And there's some stories about that too, as you can well imagine.
Yeah.
I was not modest, and it was a big shock to the entire staff when I brought my baby into the boardroom. But in any event, it was an orderly wind down. Our customers, you know, were understanding. All of our staff found jobs. So, you know, it's the biggest nightmare for an entrepreneur to have to close a business that's really
Well, it was thriving.
Off.
You were thriving.
We were yeah. really, yes, we were, we had a lot of, you know, there was a lot of great, momentum there. But then I had to dust myself off and say, you know, what's the next thing for us? And we, you know, my business partners went to other companies. Everybody found jobs. I took some time off. And then my current business partner, Bob Bright, and I had worked together since the Constellation days. And he's just a brilliant mind around pricing and cost and pricing models. And we got together and wrote on a whiteboard, you know, what is missing in our industry? You know, there were plenty of suppliers, plenty of consultants and brokers, but there was no information system that really linked customers to markets and to market information.
Without a broker.
Correct. And right. So, and what our customers said as we'd wound juice down, is they said, you know, we learned more from being your customer than we'd really ever learned, having, you know, been in deregulated markets for over a decade by then. And so they really valued the information, the data. And if you think about other deregulated markets, there's an information pathway, whether it's financial markets or, you know, travel, you know, you can you can buy and sell.
Anything you buy and sell, there's going to be an information, you know, system to help people identify the right price.
Right. And that did not exist. And I think both Bob and I thought, you know, this is a prerequisite for investing, continues to be a prerequisite for investing in energy efficiency and renewables. And so customers need access to good information.
And you are a software as a service platform. You have software that helps people see into the markets, and then you help them understand what they're seeing.
Correct. Right. And basically we took Bob's expertise in pricing and modeling and turned that into software, and then allow customers to forecast 3 years of usage and cost, so that they can, you know, really identify and understand what's driving their costs.
Well, you know, we had already invited you to come on the podcast when we started to hear more about what you do in the context of what we do here at Renew. So we're helping customers we're investing for them and then sharing the savings in energy efficiency and on-site clean energy. But, and we have a bunch of projects in New York City. We have a business development lead there. And so that's a city, maybe the flagship city for these carbon emissions targets, Local Law 97, right, which we talked about a lot of. For the first time, I heard the following. And this is true across the country in cities and states that are serious about decarbonization. They've set carbon targets for me. The only way to meet them is to electrify my heating and cooling. So I'm going to move my gas boiler to geothermal or air source heat pumps. That means an increased electricity bill, even though it's cutting out fossil fuel. And my understanding is electricity bills are going to go up. Can you, Renew, help me manage that risk that I'm going to be buying actually more electricity, and that prices are going to go up? What's going to happen to my savings from being more efficient? So what do you think? I mean, what do you tell customers about the impact of these decarbonization regulations, and how will you help them manage price risk?
Right. That's a great question. And there, you know, we have been in this business since it deregulated in the late 90s. And in those early days, we saw a lot of volatility and very high prices, much higher than what we've seen over the last decade. Then you saw, you know, the advent of fracking, which provided us with, you know, plentiful and relatively low cost natural gas. We transitioned a lot of coal plants
to gas. Right.
And so gas really sets the marginal price, or has set the marginal price for electricity in the Northeast. What we're seeing is we don't really know what will set the marginal price for electricity going forward, because we're going to phase out natural gas fired power plants. We're going to move to renewable energy for the grid, for, you know, grid scale.
And by the way, just to reiterate, that is the underlying logic of these decarbonization plans and Local Law 97 and the state plan in Massachusetts. We're going to move everybody from on-site fossil fuels in their boilers to electric programs for heating and cooling, and then we're going to clean the grid.
So that's all happening simultaneously. Yeah. It's not even sequential, which is a tremendous, massive transition. And along with this significant investment in large scale, grid scale renewables, we are now seeing that some projects in Massachusetts and New York that were approved are now appealing for increased pricing because of inflation, because of the change in interest rates, et cetera.
Big offshore wind projects, for example, are saying, I can't make money on the price I gave you.
Yeah. Correct. So, and that's, I believe the number in New York is that 25% of the expected grid scale renewables projects that would be 25% by 2030 are really up in the air right now, despite having approved contracts. So this is a very long answer to that question, but
it's a complicated question.
It's very complicated because if you look at the forward curve for power, which is, you know, how much is electricity going to cost in 24, 25, 26, and 27? 26 and 27 show significant premiums. And I think a lot of that is uncertainty. You know, are we going to be able to deliver reliable, renewable energy to power the entire grid? And, you know, the city of New York, the New York Independent System Operator, which makes sure that basically the state can reliably deliver electricity, the New York ISO says, you know, without a number of transmission projects and these large scale renewables, we may have a deficiency if we retire all these gas peaking plants in New York City in 2025 to the amount of 446 megawatts, which is for 9 hours, something like that. So all of these factors present uncertainty, likely volatility, and higher pricing. And so I think the assumption that power prices are going to increase is probably a good one. I think what we're also very likely to see is a lot of volatility. And that actually, you know, we try to tell customers that is not something to fear. It's something to take advantage of because customers like yours are always going to be price takers. And I think the mistake they've made in the past is that they've been sort of not engaged enough in the markets and not understanding the dynamics around markets. And so you miss buying opportunities when you do that. And I'm not talking about you're buying every day or you're engaging in the market, you know, daily or weekly or even monthly. But, you know, we've had a 40% decline in forward curves in the last 6 months. So customers should be
buying now
right, and looking, you know, at 2024 and 2025. And you can layer hedges and you can buy some fixed components and you can buy more index pricing. And so when customers are able to be a little bit more engaged and more knowledgeable, it can bring real value.
So it's really interesting because in the world you're describing, there's two things you could do as a business to manage your energy costs and be really more than just manage them, understand them and predict them in a way that businesses like to do, right?
Yeah.
Number one, you could invest in energy efficiency with Renew on a long-time energy services agreement.
You always want to do that.
Because you take what was a volatile price and you can now predict it because it's contracted. And that's obviously a plug, but it's actually has the benefit of being true, right? The first thing you want to do is take uncertainty out by bringing down your exposure to the market and making
the kilowatt hour. The right. Cheapest kilowatt hour is the one that's never used, actually.
It's right? Brilliant. But the second thing you can do, which is much more sophisticated in ways, is work with you, become knowledgeable about the market and and resist the temptation to panic and just buy a strip.
Correct.
What you're saying is the tools exist, i.e. your software and a team to help you understand it, to see the market and make periodic decisions.
Right.
Because we get a panicky response sometimes of just buy me a fixed price for 7 years.
Right.
We've had that.
Yeah.
So.
Well, one thing that we always try to do is with our customers is to really clarify what their objective is. You know, if a customer needs to know the cost of every kilowatt hour that runs through their meter, that's a different product and a different discussion and a different time horizon than someone who says, well, and we have customers who say, well, you know, we want to have some budget certainty, but we're willing to take some price risk because we don't want to pay premiums for every kilowatt hour that runs through our meter, you know? But what I think is really interesting about what you all are doing, and I think about the information that we can provide, is that when you model the financial impacts of an investment like this, you're really surfacing the values of your customer and of your organization. Mm-hmm. And it's an incredibly meaningful exercise, even if it's impossible to model 20 or 30 year prices. You know, you're really forcing, you know, assumptions and people to, you're forcing people to talk about the assumptions they're making about how they're going to run their operation and what
matters. Oh, that's interesting. When you do the exercise of helping them make decisions
right.
with your product,
right.
you're getting
right.
them to think about the future and articulate
right.
their goals are, what their assumptions
right.
are about their business.
Right.
That's really interesting.
I mean, my favorite story about this is we work with Cornell. Cornell's a fantastic organization. A lot of our customers care a lot about sustainability and carbon neutrality, but they have a goal of being carbon neutral by 2035. And so one of the ways they did this in the mid to late 90s was they phased out their campus cooling by investing in lake source cooling. And they had to present to their board a pro forma, 30-year pro forma of, you know, where electricity price is going to be and what's going to be the impact of investing in this project. From a carbon and environmental standpoint and a financial standpoint. And then they got the approval. It was a much higher upfront cost, lower operating cost was the assumption, basically. They got the board signed off on it. They made this investment. And then 2 years ago, they said, okay, what really happened? What really happened to electricity prices? How did our model match up with the actual, you know, realized costs? And so we helped them develop that story with a capstone project of their of students and their facilities folks, and it was fascinating. And I don't want to spoiler alert, it was a very, very good investment, and it saved them $23 million in 1996 dollars. And
wow, that's a great story.
IRR and
14% IRR, mm-hmm. investing in the lake
source cooling. And
wow,
their modeled pricing was completely wrong. Their electricity forecasts were completely wrong. But when we did the counterfactual, they underestimated pricing. They thought pricing was going to just continuously, they thought it was going to go down because of deregulation. And in fact, it was much more volatile and actually higher overall. But what that meant was when we developed the counterfactual case, they actually saved more.
Than they had thought they
yeah.
would. Wow, that's fascinating. Mm-hmm. That's really cool.
So, you know, if you're interested in learning more, it was in District Energy Magazine, which I know is
wow.
right on
I
your
just
bedside
got my,
table.
I just got my issue, the September issue. That's right next to Sports Illustrated.
Yeah, I know.
It's nice to have two people who know each other so well on the podcast.
we can just make each other giggle. Yes.
Well, this is Really, you know, these types of projects, one you're describing at Cornell, Deirdre, is something that we're still seeing, you know, colleges. I just was at a conference not too long ago, and Smith College just did something similar, you know, a 30-year pro forma, look at a campus-wide geothermal project that they just got approved. And hopefully, you know, these projects happen more often, right? I mean, I think there's just... it has to, right? Like these massive infrastructure projects have to start happening to meet these targets. Because what I've found interesting is if you look at, you know, COVID and the impact to the built environment, people stopped utilizing the building. I think the energy usage didn't really drop that much because we're still heating and cooling these properties. And, you know, there's just some massive structural changes that need to be done to create the carbon reduction.
Right. Yeah.
So,
it's great to have.
It's very cool that the
stories
did that.
Yeah.
Yeah. And they're now looking at, because they have a big cogen facility, Cornell's now looking at what are they going to do to replace the cogen. And it's probably going to be deep geothermal. Like they've been running some test wells, really interesting. And what I love also about them is that it really is a living laboratory. You know, they collaborate between the academic and facilities groups and the college students. So it's a really cool story there.
That is very cool. Well, should we move to the beer? This is
Let's
fun.
Move
we
to could, the beer.
We could set a record for the podcast.
They have to do some editing.
No, just be a two-parter. That's all.
Yeah, it's just, you know, got a good rapport going. You know, we've known each other for a while.
Yes, we have.
I will say also, I have been enjoying this beer, both beers.
Yep.
Just a reminder for everybody, we've got not just any IPA. From Destination Unknown in Long Island. And we have it's Windrow, which is the New York State corn lager. And that is from Hudson Valley Brewing. And so just to start from, we'll start from same order, Destination Unknown. It's our IPA. And both of these, Deirdre, you brought some breweries that are really into sustainability. So, it's great.
Got lucky there.
Yeah. I mean, it's we are always right at Renew where we are looking for companies. We can help you if you don't know, if you're looking to decarbonize and don't know where to start, but also we love to look for companies who are actively having these conversations and actively setting climate goals and, or at least, you know, they're cognizant of these issues, right? Even if we're a few decades late, but they're trying to get there. And so both of these breweries, we'll start with Destination Unknown. They are a EPA green partner. So they get most of their energy from wind power. So we like that. We've been talking about deregulated energy markets. And then, they also sell, use their spent grain. They recycle it and to local hog farmers for feed and also for dog treats. It has to be done relatively quickly.
Wow. Alert Olive and Stevie.
Olive and Stevie are going to have to sample those dog treats.
Yeah, they sound popular. They had a pig roast with a pig that they was fed on their spent grain.
Wow.
So that seems like
that's a circular economy.
Like
right.
Yes.
Some fulfilling event. And then they did purchase a 48-acre farm in Warwick, New York. So they are working on, they want to start growing their own hops and all their own ingredients. So they are
love that
absolutely on the sustainability path. Then we have, lastly, we have Hudson Valley Brewing.
Should we score this one first?
Sure. Yeah why not?
Score this
why not?
One.
Let's do that.
This
How
is the IPA.
Scoring this?
So there's a flavor score, and then there's a sustainability adder or detractor. And then there's a Mike Savage crushability score. Now, Mike,
crushability means how many you could drink in a night.
How many you want to drink in one sitting. I had
exactly,
it wrong until the last pot.
Yeah. Yeah. It's very much how many you want. Because you could definitely drink, you know, a lot of beers would score too high, but they'd just be water. So
right.
we gotta
exactly.
find the right balance.
So it's how many you would like to drink in one night.
And yeah, is that a yeah. 1 through 5 or is that a 1 through 10?
What's scale? The highest we've gone? I see. I don't know.
Yeah, that one has no cap.
There's no cap on it.
Yeah, yeah, I mean, I think we've never gone to double digits, so that's good.
I don't think that would be healthy for
No. But you know,
well, but you can desire to drink.
You
more
could
than
desire
you
could, without actually
would be
doing.
Good for you. Yeah. So full disclosure on the pod, Mike is at a conference in Plymouth, Michigan. He does not have the beer, so I'm playing Mike Savage on this podcast.
Okay. Let's see how well you
so
know my
Dierks,
palate.
You start, then I'm going to score it as Charlie Lord, and I'm going to finish my scoring as Mike Savage.
So the taste is that a 1 through
5? So 1 through 10.
One through 10.
Yeah. With a plus, you can add up to 1 full point for sustainability. Okay. You could add a half a point, 0.75.
I really like the flavor of this. It's smooth, but I like it. I'm going to go with a 7. I would add a half a point for sustainability.
7.5. Mm-hmm. All right. So Charlie Lord likes this IPA. It's not too hoppy at the back end. It's a little bit sweet for my taste. I tend to be high scoring. So I'm going to give it a 7 as well and a half a point for sustainability. Mike Savage is now tasting the beer. Mike Savage is going to say, it tastes like a lot of other IPAs, nothing to distinguish it. A 6 with a half point, 5.5 with a half point. Mike Savage gives it a 6.
So Mike Savage is a very discerning, has a discerning palate. You're not an IPA guy.
He's a tough grader. He's a tough grader and he doesn't usually
score the IPA. I'm a great inflator
too.
Totally.
Yeah. Mike, what do you think? How'd I do?
You did good. I mean, that's basically spot on. I mean, like, you know, I'm a blunt grader is what I would say, you know, it's gotta have something to take it to the next level. And, it didn't sound like it was going there.
No, you know what I was going to say? I think this would have been Mike. This would have been my Mike Savage. I've had this beer before. 6.
So I need to listen to the pod to hear one that really gets a solid score from Mike.
Yeah. Well, I mean, there's lots of them out there. Okay. There's some good ones.
All right.
Cool. All right. So let's move to the Windrow. Will you tell us about their sustainability? Nathan?
Yeah. I can also give a quick score for, Destination Unknown. I think I'm also going with the 7.5. I think it's pretty it's generic. A good IPA. Mm-hmm. It has some complexity and they're working on sustainability. So I think 7.5 is pretty solid there. I'll be calculating our ratings here.
Right. Cause we slot them in.
Right.
Exactly. Real time. We figure out where they go in the all time.
Exactly.
Cool. Yeah. Wow.
So, awesome. Next we have Hudson Valley, which this was the corn lager. Which I will say I am liking. And Hudson Valley Brewing, they're a little bit further in their sustainability initiatives, it seems. Definitely doing lots of good things. They are part of the Town of Beacon's Clean Power Initiative, which is also, I believe, associated with a CCA, a community choice aggregation, right? Yeah. So it's a municipal aggregation that allows local governments to procure power on behalf of residents, businesses, and municipal accounts with alternative suppliers and more green energy, right? Mm-hmm. So just
exciting,
right? Yeah. It's topical to what we've been talking about. Mm-hmm. They're part of it and it does include, community solar. So they're 100% of their electricity usage is coming from renewable energy. Wonderful.
So, dear, do you want to read the thing about the boat? Or you?
Yes. Well,
yeah.
Or you go ahead. I love this.
All right.
This is a great story.
This is Hudson Valley Brewing. They have a new beer called Glimmer, which we're not drinking. But here's what they say. The grain for Glimmer, as well as a growing portion of the grain for our local farmhouse ale program, was delivered to us fully without the use of fossil fuels. While shipping remains a large part of our carbon footprint, our work with the St. Apollonia schooner helps us lower the impact. The grains are ferried down the Hudson River from Germantown, New York, aboard a sailboat.
I mean, come on.
Are you kidding me? And then
Can you give them 10 for sustainability and effort?
We're going to go. We're going to change the scale. And
wait till you get to this part.
And then pedaled up the hill to our brewery with electric assist bicycles. I like
pedaled
the honesty there.
Up the hill. Now,
I like
they
the
do say it's
electrical
assist. Yeah.
Yeah.
They could have just said bikes.
They should have got horses.
That's too.
Where's
that's
the
too
Amish
high
when
carbon,
you need them?
That's too high carbon. Yeah. That's carbon.
That's
intensive.
True. There's some methane
feed
there.
Those. Yeah.
Yeah. So anyway, you got the boat, you got the people on the bikes bringing the grain up. I just think that's incredible. So I'm going to propose something. There's a full point for sustainability, and then there's bonus points for sailboats and bicycles.
And not only that, you stopped a little short. They're actually using, so the little plastic lids that hold the four packs. It's called Pack Tech. They have a Pack Tech reuse and recycling program.
Yeah.
I mean, they're really, really.
They're on it.
They print the labels for Glimmer on recycled craft paper. I mean, get the school kids involved is what I say.
They're really going all out, especially with this beer.
Get the school kids
They've also
this
got
does
a,
sound like the most sustainable beer we've looked at. Yes. So yeah. I wonder how it tastes.
Yes. Well, I have my Mike Savage.
Tough guy up there.
Tough guy. Mm. Dears, what's your score?
Screw the sustainability. Is it drinkable? I like it.
Exactly.
I like this. I don't know the difference between a lager and IPA. So I am, again, a great inflator here.
A lager is cold brewed and bottom fermented. There's usually less range of flavor.
I think this is quite flavorful.
It's really good.
I'm going to give this an 8.
Yep.
And I'm going to give 10 points.
You can't give 10. You can give 9. Oh, you're going to blow up the scoreboard.
All right, only one then?
But I think you could give an extra kicker for the sailboat.
2. 2 points.
You're going to give it a perfect 10.
Yeah. Yeah.
All right.
I used to tell my students as a teacher, right? You can get up to 100%.
You can get
up.
Right? Yeah. All right. Charlie Lord is giving this an 8 with a 1 point for sustainability and a 0.5 point for the sailboat. So 9.5, which is as high as
That's
I've ever
solid.
Given. And this flavor is excellent. It's one of the best
flavor.
Lagers I've ever had.
I love this flavor.
Because it's got a lot of flavor. It's crisp. It's got a little citrusy. It's really, really good. Mike Savage
has not tasted this beer.
He loves this beer. This is not a beer he just has gotten used to.
Let's see.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Right?
Mike Savage really likes this beer. The crushability score is through the roof. You want to have a lot of these.
Wow.
They go down smooth with a lot of interesting flavor. Crushability is a 5 on this one. But the standard score for Mike Savage is 7.5 with a full point and 0.5 point for the sailboat. So Savage is at a 9
wow.
on this one.
We got some. This is going to rank. I feel like we should at the end of the year do an award ceremony for all the beers we've done. And there should be a sailboat award.
For sure.
And we'll try to find some competition, but they're in a good position to win here.
Yeah, that's exactly right.
It's a small universe, breweries on rivers. We've got a beer waiting here for you when you get back from Michigan, so you can try it. And
we're going to put this
validate
one.
Validate yeah. Charlie's
You're right.
scoring.
We actually have one of each. We could actually cross-check my scoring. All right, well, this has been amazing.
All right, here.
Just like you cross-check Cornell, I will cross-check Charlie on this on these numbers here.
So yeah, you're definitely going to want it cross check because we have I'm just checking to make sure that I'm not saying something incorrect, but I do believe we have a front runner here.
What?
Yeah,
we just put them in first place.
Yeah, we did.
Okay. Is that something we're not happy about?
No.
I'm thinking is a mistake.
No.
I mean, there was a lot in there.
This was sailboat exuberance. Schooner exuberance.
And I really think it was delicious.
Did you grade? I went
with an 8 plus with the 1 point for the sustainability. So definitely 9. I really do think it's a delicious lager. It's not like it's got some good flavor to it. You can taste that
complexity
corn in there. So I think it's delicious. I'll stand by the 9. And yeah, with the IPA, Destination Unknown was an average 7.25, so it does not make the top 5, but we have with a 9.4 rounded up. That's our new front runner.
Our new number one.
Hudson Valley.
Okay, amazing. So we'll have to go back over the top 5. Yeah. So Mike, do you want to ask Deers the question of the
Yes. So Deirdre, you may or may not be prepared for this, but if anybody in the world, who would you want to have a beer with, dead or alive?
Wow. You know, my niece did warn me about this. And the first person who came to mind is Jurgen Klopp.
Oh, nice.
He's the manager of Liverpool Football Club.
That is so good. Our number one fan, Luke, will be absolutely
I was thinking,
ecstatic about that answer.
Just sit back and have a beer with this. He has a lot of advice about life, not just about soccer. So
He comes across as a wise person. I was just going to use the word wise. He would be a great person to have a beer with and a great addition to the crew. This is a great beer party.
Right.
I love it.
A great name, Jurgen Klopp. I like that.
All right. Welcome, Jurgen Klopp, to the Green Beers Beer Garden.
Fantastic.
Do you have other, who else have you guys had in that mix in the past?
We have everything from Odysseus to Tiger Woods to Nina Simone.
Cool.
Rachel Carson.
Carl Sagan.
Mm-hmm.
Babe Ruth.
Brady. Right. Brady. Tom Brady. Obama.
Tom Brady.
President Obama, I think, is in there.
Yeah.
Mike, were you Tom Brady?
I
was Brady and Obama.
Those are two heavy hitters. That's good. Yeah.
I mean, I'd love to chat with the Dalai Lama. He'd be great.
Does he drink beer?
But I don't know if he drinks beer. We've had a non-alcoholic.
We've had the athletic.
You could have a non-alcoholic beer.
There you go.
But Jurgen's my first pick.
Nice.
Yeah.
Good pick.
Love it. All right. Well, setting
Thank
the world
you so
record
much.
For longest podcast and enjoyed every single minute of it.
Thank you. That was so much fun. Yeah.
Fantastic to have you. Great to meet you and have you here in the office today
in Boston.
Well, until next time, it's been Green Beers. Thanks all.
Green Beers is brought to you by Renew Energy Partners, your partner in building decarbonization. Decarbonizing your building is good for the earth and it's a smart business move, but it's complicated and it can cost you a lot of money. Our goal is to decarbonize your building while saving you money, so all of those retrofits pay for themselves. Learn more at renewep.com.